Text 181.
Dressed up in white flannels, I went over to his lawn a little after 7 and wandered around rather ill at ease among swirls and eddies of people I didn't know. Though here and there was a face I had noticed on the commuting train. I was immediately struck by the number of young Englishmen dotted about, all well-dressed, all looking a little hungry, and all talking in low, earnest voices to solid and prosperous Americans. I was sure that they were selling something, bonds or insurance or automobiles. They were at least agonizingly aware of the easy money in the vicinity and convinced that it was theirs for a few words in the right key. As soon as I arrived, I made an attempt to find my host, but the 2 or 3 people of whom I asked his whereabouts stared at me in such an amazed way and denied so vehemently any knowledge of his movements that I slunk off in the direction of the cocktail table, the only place in the garden where a single man could linger without looking purposeless and alone. I was on my way to get roaring drunk from sheer embarrassment when Jordan Baker came out of the house and stood at the head of the marble steps, leaning a little backward and looking with contemptuous interest down into the garden. Welcome or not, I found it necessary to attach myself to someone before I should begin to address cordial remarks to the passers-by. "Hello!" I roared, advancing toward her. My voice seemed unnaturally loud across the garden. "I thought you might be here," she responded absently as I came up. "I remembered you lived next door to..." She held my hand impersonally as a promise that she'd take care of me in a minute and gave ear to 2 girls in twin yellow dresses who stopped at the foot of the steps. "Hello!" they cried together. "Sorry you didn't win." That was for the golf tournament. She had lost in the finals the week before. "You don't know who we are," said one of the girls in yellow, "but we met you here about a month ago." "You've dyed your hair since then," remarked Jordan. And I started, but the girls had moved casually on, and her remark was addressed to the premature moon, produced like the supper, no doubt, out of a caterer's basket. With Jordan's slender golden arm resting in mine, we descended the steps and sauntered about the garden. A tray of cocktails floated at us through the twilight, and we sat down at a table with the 2 girls in yellow and 3 men, each one introduced to us as Mr. Mumble. "Do you come to these parties often?" inquired Jordan of the girl beside her. "The last one was the one I met you at," answered the girl in an alert, confident voice. She turned to her companion. "Wasn't it for you, Lucille?" It was for Lucille, too. "I like to come," Lucille said. "I never care what I do, so I always have a good time. When I was here last, I tore my gown on a chair, and he asked me my name and address. Inside of a week, I got a package from Croriers with a new evening gown in it."
"Did you keep it?" asked Jordan.
"Sure I did. I was going to wear it tonight, but it was too big in the bust and had to be altered. It was gas blue with lavender beads. $265. "There's something funny about a fellow that'll do a thing like that," said the other girl eagerly. "He doesn't want any trouble with anybody." "Who doesn't?" I inquired. "Gatsby. Somebody told me..." The 2 girls and Jordan leaned together confidentially. "Somebody told me they thought he killed a man once." A thrill passed over all of us. The 3 Mr. Mumbles bent forward and listened eagerly.
"I don't think it's so much that," argued Lucille skeptically.
"It's more that he was a German spy during the war." One of the men nodded in confirmation.
"I heard that from a man who knew all about him, grew up with him in Germany," he assured us positively.
"Oh no," said the first girl. "It couldn't be that, because he was in the American Army during the war." As our credulity switched back to her, she leaned forward with enthusiasm. "You look at him sometimes when he thinks nobody's looking at him. I'll bet he killed a man." She narrowed her eyes and shivered. Lucille shivered.
We all turned and looked around for Gatsby. It was testimony to the romantic speculation he inspired that there were whispers about him from those who found little that it was necessary to whisper about in this world. There was dancing now on the canvas in the garden. Old men pushing young girls backward in eternal graceless circles. Superior couples holding each other tortuously, fashionably, and keeping in the corners, and a great number of single girls dancing individualistically, or relieving the orchestra for a moment of the burden of the banjo or the traps. By midnight, the hilarity had increased. A celebrated tenor had sung in Italian, and a notorious contralto had sung in jazz, and between the numbers, people were doing stunts all over the garden, while happy, vacuous bursts of laughter rose toward the summer sky. A pair of stage twins, who turned out to be the girls in yellow, did a baby act in costume, and champagne was served in glasses bigger than finger bowls. The moon had risen higher, and floated in the sound was a triangle of silver scales, trembling a little to the stiff, tinny drip of the banjos on the lawn. I was still with Jordan Baker. We were sitting at a table with a man of about my age and a rowdy little girl who gave way upon the slightest provocation to uncontrollable laughter. I was enjoying myself now. I had taken two finger bowls of champagne, and the scene had changed before my eyes into something significant, elemental, and profound. At a lull in the entertainment, the man looked at me and smiled. "Your face is familiar," he said politely. "Weren't you in the 1st Division during the war?" "Why, yes. I was in the 28th Infantry. I was in the 16th until June 1918. I knew I'd seen you somewhere before." We talked for a moment about some wet, gray little villages in France. Evidently, he lived in this vicinity, for he told me that he had just bought a hydroplane and was going to try it out in the morning. "Want to go with me, old sport? Just near the shore along the Sound?" "What time?" "Any time that suits you best." It was on the tip of my tongue to ask his name when Jordan looked around and smiled. "Having a gay time now?" she inquired. "Much better." I turned again to my new acquaintance. "This is an unusual party for me. I haven't even seen the host. I live over there." I waved my hand at the invisible hedge in the distance. "And this man Gatsby sent over his chauffeur with an invitation." For a moment, he looked at me as if he failed to understand. "I'm Gatsby," he said suddenly. "What?" I exclaimed. "Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought you knew, old sport. I'm afraid I'm not a very good host." He smiled understandingly, much more than understandingly. It was one of those rare smiles with a quality of eternal reassurance in it that you may come across 4 or 5 times in life. It faced, or seemed to face, the whole external world for an instant, and then concentrated on you with an irresistible prejudice in your favor. It understood you just so far as you wanted to be understood, believed in you as you would like to believe in yourself, and assured you that it had precisely the impression of you that, at your best, you hoped to convey. Precisely at that point, it vanished, and I was looking at an elegant young roughneck, a year or two over 30, whose elaborate formality of speech just missed being absurd. Sometime before he introduced himself, I got a strong impression that he was picking his words with care. Almost at the moment when Mr. Gatsby identified himself, a butler hurried toward him with the information that Chicago was calling him on the wire. He excused himself with a small bow that included each of us in turn. "If you want anything, just ask for it, old sport," he urged me. "Excuse me, I will rejoin you later."